Any questions from last time? We were starting on renormalization group, right? And I'm not sure how much to do here, but the bottom line was we were interested in, supposing we're interested in some sort of a cross section for a process or something. So we had some quantity, which I can't remember what I was calling then, probably gamma, which depended on energy and masses and dimensionless variables like angles and a coupling constant, which was renormalized. And we're going to renormalize coupling constant, which depended on some scale where we defined it. And it could depend on that scale. And the explicit dependence on the scale where we define the coupling constant is canceling the implicit dependence of the scale in physical quantities. And we were interested in doing dimensional analysis for this thing. We're interested in the regime where energies were large compared to mass. Naively, you'd like to scale out powers of the energy. So if the energy on dimensional grounds, you can always write this energy to some power, where delta is the dimensions of gamma times 1 m over e, x was dimensionless, g was dimensionless. You could write mu over e here, but it doesn't matter because you think of this thing being the dimensionless function of mu divided by some other scale. You can write those two scales divided by e if you like, and it's the same answer. So the observation was that if you didn't have this last factor, it would have been tempting to say, well, if the energy is large compared to the mass, this is effectively something which we can Taylor expand in powers of mass over energy. And then the leading behavior would have been a simple power of energy. And that gets things wrong in field theory, because in field theory, things are typically not analytic in the limit that mass goes to zero, and because of the existence of these large logarithms. So we're going to avoid that by several things we could do. We could look at, so there's two sources of there were two sources of non-analytic behavior as m goes to zero. We just had the infrared divergences in amplitudes. And then also if we renormalize things on mass shells, so we renormalize the mass shell condition in both cases is a source of non-analytic behavior. So what we do is we're going to avoid these things. So what I was doing last time was thinking about, one way to deal with this is we could do the Bloch-Nortzsch thing, and we could be describing here the physical process where we've summed over final states, soft photons in the final states, and so this is some infrared non-singular physical process that would deal with this issue. Alternatively, we could look at Green's functions, but the Green's functions are going to complicate the argument in a way which I haven't tracked through yet, because Green's functions are correlations of operators. The operators all have wave function renormalizations, and I haven't been following that in this argument yet. So let's imagine that we're looking at an infrared safe observable when we make this argument. And the second issue, what we do is we just never renormalize on mass shell. So the words were that we were going to define the coupling not to be to do with, we'll define the renormalized couplings not in terms of some correlation function when the external lines are on mass shell. We'll just take it at some random point in momentum space where the scale of the momentum is order mu. But because it's not on mass shell, we won't get these infrared divergences that came from doing subtractions on mass shell. So that was implicit in this story. So given that choice, then we don't have to worry about the limit as m over e goes to zero. But we do have to worry about the singularities that might be in the renormalized couplings. Because the argument last time was that if we chose mu to be of order e, then there are no singularities in, you know, mu of re is not small, so we don't have to worry about there being singularities for a small mu of re. And so in the limit that, so E is equal to mu, and those are both much bigger than m, then we have that gamma of E mx g of mu. Is approximately e to the delta gamma of 1. I'll just like this. I won't write it as 0 here. X, G. So here's a function where we can do the, so we can Taylor expand here. Because we've avoided these two problems. But we know that you know, G of E is the thing that could have, or the interesting E dependence is essentially in there. That's where we left off. So we'd like to know what G of E is once and for all. Yeah. Well, you can kind of infer what it was by calculating other physical processes and ask how they depend on G. You know, as long as you it's the same logic as before, that if you have, you know, if you have, say, three parameters like that, and you have three observables, you calculate them as functions of those parameters, and you can figure out how the observables dependent on those parameters if you want to know the numerical value of those parameters. It's kind of less direct than just directly defining this thing to be some scattering process, say. So there's a missing, so what I'd like to do is say that, well, we know what G of E is. So there's two directions I want to go. I want to push this without going, at some point I want to go back and think of Green's functions where we have to worry about the wave function normalizations. But I want to come back to that later on. I want to first carry the argument forward where we don't worry about that. So we're thinking about, you know, cross sections or something that are not correlation functions, but are also infrared safe, so we don't have the infrared divergences there. So for this thing, you know, what we know about these couplings is that what we'd like to know is how G depends on E. And we did a calculation before where we renormalized, you know, in QED, the coupling, the electromagnetic coupling, say. But we renormalized it in a very specific way. We renormalized it in dimensional regularization, and we followed how it depended on the scale mu that arose in dimensional regularization, which is not necessarily the same thing as what's going on here, because here, you know, we could be defining G as the value of some Green's function or some amplitude at some off-shell point mu. And what we'd like to do is relate, so we know what the answer is for G as a function of mu if we had done things in dimensional regularization. And what we'd like to know is how relevant that is for G defined in other ways. And so there's two things to say there. One of them is in perturbation theory, we can ask just in general for small g, how can G depend on mu? And we can do that by setting up the differential equation for G as a function of mu, as we did in the case of dimensional regularization. But then we can also, so that's one thing I'd like to do. And then you can follow the various options that depending on how the derivative of G with respect to mu behaves for small g, you can identify the qualitatively different things that could happen for G as a function of mu. But the second thing is we could ask, if we have different ways of defining renormalized couplings, how do their mu dependencies compare? And the claim there is that for small g, the first few terms in this expansion and powers of coupling don't really care about how you define them. And so in the end of the day, we're actually going to be able to use the dimensional regularization formula for G of E for G defined more generally. because things won't depend on the scheme in an important way. So how do we want to set that up? So so what we want is figure out what G of E is. So if we chose one of these things, some amplitude like this, to define what G is, so suppose G of mu is defined as the value. So now this was some arbitrary gamma. Let's say we choose some particular gamma, and that's the thing that's going to define G. Particular IR safe cross section. And I'll call that capital G, just to at a specific energy, etc. So we're imagining that the definition of G of mu is that we have some amplitude like the ones we've been talking about, and we choose at the energy equals mu, and it could have been a function of mass, could have been a function of various angles that define the process, and we'll just choose some reference ones. And then it'll depend on the coupling, but it'll depend on the coupling defined at some other point. So let's say that it's a reference point. So imagine we're in QED. We've calculated some process as a function of the bare coupling. That's what I mean by this coupling dependence here. If we make the same arguments as before, so let's imagine that we'll take mu and mu naught both to be much bigger than m. So then this is going to be this is dimensionless. So when we're focusing on a special case where delta is zero, so this will be I can write this as I can pull mu naught out. So this will be a function of mu over mu naught m over mu naught x reference g over mu naught one. And so we can ask what mu dd mu is. And it'll be, if I call this, it's if we differentiate back to the first variable here, let's call that y. So it'll be y ddy of g is a function of the variable y. M over mu naught. See, nothing else here depends on mu because. And if everybody is big compared to the mass, we can think of this as being approximately zero. And mu is arbitrary here. So once we've done this derivative, we could choose to evaluate it at mu naught, in which case the right-hand side depends on some extraneous variables, you know, which we have been set to be equal to the numbers. But the one variable it really is a function of, so if we take mu naught equal mu, then we can, this thing is a function of g of mu, which we call beta. Yeah?
Why are you taking the ratio inside the arguments of g, but you don't change, you don't take anything else?
I mean, why didn't I put the ratio here rather than like I did here? Nothing like this? Yeah. Just because I'm imagining G to be a dimensionless quantity. So I've chosen the special case where gamma was dimensionless, which is with delta case delta equals zero.
So G isn't a cross section?
G won't be a cross. You could define it to be a cross section. I'm doing this in a trivial sense. It could be a cross section. If it were a cross section, it would have dimensions. And so I'll just define it to be a dimensionless thing times mu to the, in that case, mu to the minus 2. So I'll factor out as many powers of mu as I need to make it dimensionless. And if I had done that, then this power of E we would have pulled out in the definition of G would have canceled the powers of mu that I would have put in the definition of the coupling constant. So So I could do this for not only the in QED, not only for the electromagnetic coupling, I could do it for the coefficient of psi bar psi, so the, you know, the mass parameter. In the, but just by defining, I'd want to choose something which cares about that parameter, and the dimensions that that carries, I would factor out a power of mu to eat up the dimensions, and the what's multiply that would be the thing that's the dimensionless coupling I'm talking about here. So it's, so I could use a cross section if you like. It's not going to be a real problem. So if this had been a cross section, we would have had a delta would be minus 2. We would have had an E over minus 2 here. So here we would have had a mu to the minus 2. And my definition of the dimensionless G would have been the cross section, the coefficient of mu to the minus 2. So before, so what we're interested in is if we knew what this was, we could integrate this to get G of mu. But for small g, you know, if this, I'm thinking here now of it being like the electromagnetic coupling, we can say something about the dependence. You know, if G of mu is much less than 1, then for the electromagnetic coupling, if the coupling was 0, then, you know, a theory being free was true at all scales, so that so if the coupling's small, we can take beta and we can expand it in powers of g. And we're expecting it to vanish at g equals 0. And the examples, like for the what I'm telling you now is something which need not be true, say, for the masses. But for things like the electromagnetic coupling for QED, if we had set that coupling to 0, then we had a free theory. And so for free theory, we weren't expecting anything to, there was nothing fancy that had to happen. There was no fancy renormalization for the coupling. And so in the case of a free theory, we weren't expecting the coupling to change as we changed scales. And so beta was vanishing if the coupling were 0. And so if we expand around small coupling, the first term will be 0 in that case. And so we expect this thing to start off being some number times g to some power. Power we expect to be higher order than g itself. So typically, since things are you know, if we're doing an expansion in powers of g, it has to start off with g squared. Could have been, you could have imagined the first few terms could have been 0. So there could be special cases where the starting power is higher than 2, but the generic situation will be that it'll be 2 plus 4 j g cubed. And this coefficient b is some number. And so we can ask kind of, if you integrate this equation for this choice, you know, what happens to G as a function of the choices we make for this number? So we can take several cases. So let's take the case, you know, if B is negative, so let's write it as being, you know, minus little b, where the little b is positive. So then if we plot, beta against g, what we know is that for small g, it's going down. What we don't know is what happens as you keep on going. So it could be that if you get it for larger g, maybe it turns around, or maybe it just goes off forever. But you don't really, if we start off in this region for small g, the physical region will be, you know, g positive. G here, I'm going to imagine g. It depends on the definition of g. So I won't actually focus on that. But so if we're in this situation, and you start off somewhere like here, then qualitatively you know what's going to happen, right? So here, if g is small and positive, then beta is, you know, because b is negative, then beta is negative. That means that dg d mu is negative, and that means that you're pushed back in that direction if you start off down here somewhere. So if you start off here, you're just pushed back to this point, and then once you sit here, then at g equals 0, beta vanishes, and so that you'll stay there. So this case is one for which if you start off in the weak coupling regime, you'll stay in the weak coupling regime. Sorry? The linear term is not there because if you think about QED, what happened, right? So I guess I'm not making a blanket statement. I'm saying that if this had been a mass, for instance, you could have gotten something which would have, if you had the mass and the coupling, you could have had something where the running of the mass was proportional to the mass, but also depend on the coupling, say. You know, in the example we looked at, where we looked at how the electromagnetic coupling ran, what we were doing is we were starting off with a coupling like that, and then we added to it a graph like that, and so we added, so the change to E was the thing that was contributing to it was 2 powers higher in E, and so you know, what's going to happen is that if the coupling that's deviating, if the difference between U and a free theory is G, then the interactions. I guess first statement would be that nothing I'm saying here would have been different as far as this picture goes if this power were 1 rather than 2. So the story of the direction you flow is just the sign that I'm talking about here, right? But in the real cases of interest, it's true that you're doing a series in G, and the left-hand side here is order G, the fact that you're running it all is because you're including interactions. So you had to go to some non-trivial order in the perturbation expansion. So that means that the right-hand side is something which is first going to arrive at higher order than order G. If you're doing things in perturbation theory, it would be, you know, by assumption analytic. So you could have worried if it was a mass that you know, non-analytic things could happen, but we're kind of specifically staying away from problems that would come from mass singularities. You know, so I wouldn't sell this too hard. I just basically, I'm making an assumption here that it's starting off at the quadratic level, and that's the one that's going to apply in all the cases that we're really going to care about. And in that case, if you start here with this, if this is what happens. If you start here, you're driven always back to the weak coupling area. So if you start at weak coupling, you're driven farther into weak coupling as mu increases. And that's the case of that's what's known as asymptotic freedom. As you go to higher energies, you're just getting weaker and weaker coupled. So that's like case one. Case two, that's not what we found in QED, right? When in QED, when we did the calculation, we found something like this, but where B was positive. So case two would be if B is equal to plus B, greater than zero. Then again, if you're plotting beta against G, so we know that it's kind of going up for small g. But now the thing is that if you start off at some value of G, you know, because we know that mu dg d mu is B g squared, let's say. If you start here, because beta is positive, that means that dg d mu is positive, and that means that g, as mu increases, g is being driven to larger values. So unlike here, where if you start near weak coupling, you flow towards weak coupling for large mu, now what will happen is that you're going to flow away from weak coupling for large mu if you start with positive g. So there's kind of two cases to compare. This, you know, so this curve could go up and go back down again, and it could cross the axis at some point, you know, g sub c. Or what might happen is you might have something like it could just grow and grow and grow. And so if you take call us say 2A, call that 2B. So in the case 2A, what'll happen is that you're going to flow along here until you come down in this direction. But once you get here, you'll stop because at that point beta is zero, and so that means that g mu is zero. So this g is going to be a fixed point. It'll be something where as mu increases, g will increase, but then once you get to that point, it'll stop. So in case 2A, if initially you're in weak coupling region, and g, so there's several cases. It could be that if this is a small g, it could also be in the weak coupling region. So depending on your theory, this may or may not be inside the weak coupling region. The generic situation is that it's not in weak coupling, but you can design theories where it is. Larger values as mu increases. So if it's true that it passes through zero, you know, we could ask how things behave there. So so near G is GC, we can expand beta around G equals GC now, if you like. And so it doesn't have to be, I've drawn it as if it crosses here, so I've drawn it assuming that beta of G near G equals GC is some constant, let's say C times G minus GC. It could have been squared, in which case it could have been turned up again or whatever, but the simplest case will be if it's just going through zero linearly. And then in that case, we can integrate. So then in this regime, we've got mu dg dmu is approximately, actually, I don't think I used C when I did this in my notes, so let me just use the same notation. I use a different, I guess the way I've drawn this, C has to be negative, right? So I might as well put the explicit sign in. So if we integrate that, we're going to have the G of mu in this vicinity is going to look like G sub C plus a constant times mu to the minus C. So A is mu dependent. So as mu goes to infinity, what happens is that G goes to G sub C like a power of 1 over mu. I could have done the integration here too, right? If we earlier did this already, right? If we had, in this case, if we integrate mu dg d mu equal to minus b g squared, and you know that integrates to 1 over g squared of mu, 1 over g squared of mu naught plus b log mu over mu naught. So if mu gets very large, so as mu goes to infinity, g of mu g squared of mu is 1 over so it's going to zero here logarithmically. Because here it's going like some power law of mu. The third case, so let's say case 2b, what happens depends on what happens to beta as g gets large. And so if it's true that beta goes to infinity as g goes to infinity faster than linear. G, I think that's what I want to assume. Yeah. Then we can also integrate, so then we're integrating dg d mu is beta. So another way of writing that is that, you know, dg over beta of g is equal to d mu over mu. So that says that log of mu over mu naught is equal to the integral from g naught to g of g prime over beta of g. So if beta is growing for large g faster than linear in g, that says that, so as mu goes to infinity, this size goes to infinity. And because the only way that that can happen is that g has to go to infinity for some, let me make this right. So if this is going faster than the relevance of this condition is that if beta is going faster than 1 over g, then that means this is converging for large g. This integral is converging. So if g went to infinity as mu went to infinity, then we'd have a contradiction because even if this limit is infinite, this integrand is converging, and so this integral is going to some finite value, which would be inconsistent with saying that mu is infinite. So the only way that this can make sense would be that if mu goes to infinity, what has to happen is that at some finite value of g has to go to infinity. Sorry, yeah, what did I say? Yeah, that's what I wanted to say. Although, you know, if I look at that now, why is that being forced on me? So the claim I'm trying to make is that g of mu cannot be bounded for all finite mu and only diverge as mu goes to infinity because of this assumption here. Because the integral from g naught to infinity g prime of beta g prime converges. So what has to happen if this is not true, there has to be some point where for some finite mu, g goes to infinity. So now the problem with this is that if we're defining this coupling to be, you know, the value of some cross section or something, that means that something physical blew up there. And so that would be a problem, right? Because we know when things are supposed to blow up. If a cross section is blowing up, that means, you know, we saw that it did blow up sometimes, and that was like when you put particles on shell. But unitarity was kind of telling you when these things blow up. You're not expecting cross sections to blow up at some random place not related to physical particles being present. And so this kind of thing is regarded as a bad thing. So that's kind of like the Landau disease or Landau pole, you could call it if it was a pole, or Landau disease. So theories for which this happens are you believe that they're sick. We don't know of any example, a known example where you have a theory that makes sense where this happens in the regime where you trusted the theory. what typically happens is that you can calculate beta in perturbation theory. So if we had calculated that beta was in case 2a, if we had trusted, even though we did, you know, this statement that beta goes like g squared, that's something which we're only really believing for small g squared. But if we'd actually believed it was true for all g squared, then that would have been an example that fits this pattern. And if we integrate, so you know, we can integrate we can integrate those equations, and it's essentially the same as integrating these equations with a sign change here. And so what would happen is that, unlike, you know, here I've neglected this term, but if we solve this equation with a sign change here, what will happen is that there will be a pole that g squared will go to infinity when these guys cancel each other. And so there's lots of examples of functions which have that problem. But in real theories like QED, where it's arising in this way, where you're solving this equation, but the sign is different, you don't really trust the theory. You don't really believe that the beta function was given by a quadratic function at the point where the pole is happening, because it's happening at some large value, large enough value where the couplings are large. But that would tell you that you don't really trust quantum electrodynamics up to arbitrarily large scales, because if you did, well, if you, no, actually, I take that back. It depends on what the real beta function is. There's an argument you can make there, but I'm making it wrong. So these are kind of the three of the broad options that happen. And you don't want this to happen. But really, it's difficult to know, because you're interested in the large G limit, and most of your information of what beta is perturbative. It's very rare that you would know that you are in that, you know, that you've hit that case. Yeah. I think there's in principle nothing, no reason why that couldn't happen. I just think there's no general statement that you make there. Right, so this is kind of what could have happened. But in quantum electrodynamics, I've been talking like this is what happens in quantum electrodynamics, but there's a missing step, because the way we've been defining the G's, you know, if defining G's this way is not the way we've ever calculated what this beta function is. All we've ever done, the only calculation we've done where we actually have evaluated B and found something like this was for QED in dimensional regularization. So a missing step is to say that what we found for G in that case also applies for G defined in this case. So let me make that argument. So let's ask, how does beta depend on the precise definition? Precise renormalization scheme. So let's imagine that we're in perturbation theory. So we're interested in being near the weak coupling limit. So we got our beta function. Let's say we got more than one coupling. Given a bunch of couplings, let's call them G sub I. We could take, you know, mu d g d mu, and that'll define a bunch of betas. And these betas, so let's suppose that these betas are going to be given by some power series. And let's start them off at the quadratic level, like I have been doing. And let me use the same notation that I have been using. So I guess before we talk about the power series, you know, if we ask, so let's suppose that we have a different way of defining these couplings. So let's say we've got G twiddle I's, which are the same couplings defined using different conditions. So they're functions of the G's. Different renormalization scheme. So maybe this is dimensional regularization, and these guys are defined by setting some Green's functions to some value. So then the beta functions for these new guys, so mu g twiddle d mu, so that'll be given by, if I differentiate through, it's going to be, you know, df dg sub j times mu times dg sub j, which is the beta function for the jth coupling. So if I define this to be, you know, beta twiddle I, it's related to the beta function for these guys through this Jacobian, which is defined, you know, the Jacobian that's tells me how these things are related to one another. So let's suppose we're in perturbation theory. So perturbatively, in this case, the coupling, we'll imagine that the coupling starts off, let's say that G twiddle I is equal to G sub I plus the corrections, and these corrections, let's imagine them to be series in G. And let me make sure I use the same notation for what I had done before. Let's call this K. So we'll have K I J. I J L. So I'm imagining this is a series. So we've got something linear in G. We want something quadratic in G here. So we'll have G J G L in the higher orders. And so the derivative that we're talking about here, so df I d g j will be delta I j plus k I j l d l. And let's imagine that the beta function for these first coupling is, and I'll use the same notation again, so I want to call it b I j k, something quadratic, g j g k, plus higher order, and I want to use the same thing, so let's call it C I J K L G J G K G L. So if we just chase it through and just evaluate this thing, so B twiddle I is going to be, so the first thing will be this derivative, so it'll be this thing, delta I J K I J L G L. And then the beta function we're looking at here starts, it's beta J we're interested in, so we'll have B J, and I've used L, so let's say M N. Done that right? I haven't, because there's a factor 2 here. The derivative. What else have I gotten wrong? That's it. Yep. No.
Why are you always getting a factor 2?
Because this is just a dummy variable, right? This j. I could have written mn here.
Yeah.
So if I differentiate with respect to gj, there half the time the gj will be here, and the other half the time they'll be here. So if I had just written, if this had been xi, xj, you probably would have been quite happy for me to have this factor 2 there, wouldn't you? I think you're thinking that GJ is only here, so I only have to differentiate that. I don't have to differentiate that. But that's a fallacy because of this is really a dummy index. All right. So the claim is, if I just group these terms, this is BJMN times GM. That's that term plus K. How do I want to write this? NRGR. Here, the thing I haven't written down here is order G to the fourth, right? So plus GN. So I don't want to use N here. I'm going to start running out of letters here, so I guess A, B, G, A, G, B, G, N, G, R. So up to order G to the fourth, all these extra terms that were, if I expand this out, the terms we have are exactly what you would have had if you had written, you know, basically B times G plus K G squared twice plus C times G plus K G squared three times plus order G to the fourth. And this is exactly, this is G twiddle. So so that says that beta twiddle I is basically, oh, sorry. That's why my indices got askew here. It should have been an I. And this should also be an I. I wondered why I was running out of letters. So it's basically B, I, J, K, G, twiddle, J, G, twiddle, K. And so what that tells you is that under some random redefinition, provided that the in perturbation theory it was the corrections, you know, the redefinition started at order G squared, whatever your beta function was for the original variables, you know, beta, if it had the series expansion like this, then after the redefinition, you've got a beta function which has the same series expansion up to this order. Once you get to order G to the fourth, things can change. So this need not be the same. Or G and G twiddle. But this is the same. So this is so beta twiddle as a function of G twiddle is the same as beta as a function of G. So that says that the first two terms of your beta function don't depend on how you define your coupling. And so that's what justifies, in the end of the day, taking the beta function as calculated, say, in minimal subtraction using dimensional regularization as we had done before, and applying it to, for this first quadratic term, to a coupling which is defined in some more indirect way. So in particular, for QED in minimal subtraction, what we found was that if mu de d mu, in that case, somewhere I've written that down. Where was that written down? So that was equal to b e squared, where b was equal to 1 over 6 pi squared, I think. Yeah. Or another useful way to write this would be that if alpha is e squared over 4 pi, so that means that mu d alpha d mu is going to be twice 2e times dE d mu. So that would be 2e squared, so this is going to be 2e cubed. What happened there? Oh, I'm lying to you already. So it's this expression here wasn't right, right? This is I'm reading notes which were actually not the original notes. Let's go back. Let's go make that. Go right back to the original notes. What I actually wrote down was this would have been true for if I had chosen e squared as the variable. So this would have been e to the fourth. If you go back to what I had done earlier in the term. So let me see if I can find that. And you kind of see that had to be right because the way it had to be true in fact I drew this graph and then I misled you when I said the thing was quadratic. If this is contributing to mu dE d mu, it's going to do that at the level of e cubed, right? There's three e's there, so it'll be some number, and so that is what we would have gotten from the direct calculation. And so when I write it in this way as the square of something, it's really e squared is the variable for which we've got the square here of what we started off with here. So the way I had actually calculated it back in the original calculation for dE, I'm just not finding it is the problem. Right, here we go. Yeah. If you remember what happened when we were doing this before is that we had E were normalized was Z to some power times E bare, and Z was 1 plus order E squared. And so we had the change. So the E renormalized was E bare plus something cubic in E times a logarithm. And so if I took mu d d mu, to kill off the logarithm, I picked off something cubic. And so what I'm telling you here is the same. It doesn't look the same, but it is the same. That this choice of numbers is what we were getting before. And so let me just erase this. So kind of a more convenient way, if we just divide here by, if we take DD, if we divide this by 4 pi, then we would have had 64, or 24 pi cubed. So we have 24 pi cubed. I'm actually surprised now that, So I want to write this as alpha to the fourth. So we'll have our alpha squared. So alpha squared would have had a 16 pi squared. So we'll have a pi down here. We had a 24 and we wanted 16. So what are we missing? We're missing, we wanted 2 times 8. We've got 3 times 8. So this will be 2/3. We have 16 times 8 times 3 is 24. Yeah. Okay. So in mineral extraction, this was true. And that means that in other ways of defining it, it'll also be true that this is the leading behavior for the coupling, for small coupling. And so this tells us that we're in case, we're in case 2, either A or B. We don't know what happens when the coupling gets large. We do know we're being driven away from small coupling as mu gets large. Right. So at this point, let me just quote the answers. If you just take the simple field theories, it was a longstanding observation that if you took your Lagrangian to be phi to the 4 theory, so you took minus 1/2 d phi squared minus 1/2 m squared phi squared minus lambda over 4 factorial phi to the 4th, and do the same thing, calculate mu d lambda d mu, then in that case it turns out to be also positive. So it starts off, it turns out being, so it's 3. I guess the way I'm writing it in my notes, it starts off being lambda. Let's do it the honest way. So it's 3 over lambda squared over 16 pi squared. It turns out the next term is also calculated. So then there's a 17 over 3 lambda cubed over 16 pi squared. And so again, for small lambda, it's again positive. Leave that down. Try and make it stay down. And it was a. It took a while for people to find examples where the beta function is negative that were asymptotically free. But famously, the non-abelian gauge series, for non-abelian gauge series, it is 3. So if you take for non-abelian gauge theories, so these are the ones which we haven't actually talked about, but which I think you saw in the PSI course theories. So this is where the field strength F B nu alpha is d mu A alpha nu minus D nu A mu alpha plus C alpha beta gamma. And the covariant derivatives for fields like scalars have generators for a non-abelian group. So I'm going to say G PA IJ. I guess I'm using alpha here, so alpha mu. So where these generators T alpha commuted with T beta give you the structure constant, so I C gamma alpha beta T gamma. Then the running of these couplings depends, it gets contributions from loops of gauge fields because they couple to themselves, because when you write the kinetic term where this is squared, you get things like this times this and this times this. It also gets contributions where the charge fields, loops of the charge fields will contribute to the running of G. And so the statement is that if alpha, again, is G squared over 4 pi, then the claim is that if you calculate this, it's equal to minus alpha squared over 2 pi. And then there's contributions from the spin 1, spin 0, and spin 1/2. So the contribution from spin 1 is 11/3 times the, I'll explain what these things are in a second. Contribution from spin 1/2 is minus 2/3 times C R 1/2. The contribution from spin 1 is minus 1/3 C R 0. And what these C's are so the idea is that in some representation, if I take T alpha, the trace of T alpha, T beta, that's always equal to, for these groups, it's always proportional to delta alpha beta. And the proportionality constant is the definition of C. But the number depends on the representation you used. So if I take the trace in representation R, this number, this defines what this C of R is. So R equals representation of the group. So it depends on whatever these matrices are. So for example, if for SU2, the TAs could have been 1/2 the Pauli matrices. And if we'd done that, then C of R in that case would have been 2. Because if you take the Pauli matrices and put them in there, you get 2. So R of 0 then is if you take all the scalar fields and write them as a big column vector, and you take the representation of the gauge fields that's appearing there, when you write all the scalar fields in the column vector, that's what R sub 0 is. So it's the representation for the scalar fields. It might be reducible. Similarly, R sub 1/2 is the representation for spin 1/2. And then A is the adjoint representation. That's because the gauge fields are always in the adjoint representation. And what the adjoint representation is, it's the recognition is that the, if I one choice for these T's is the structure functions themselves. So it's always true, the Jacobi identity, that if I take the commutator of a T with a T with a T, and that always gives me 0, that's an identity on these C's, which you can interpret as meaning that these C's as a matrix satisfy this generating property. And so there's factors of I probably in there somewhere, but basically these C's themselves can be used to make a representation. And that's what you mean by the adjoint representation. So it's a free representation if you have the structure constants. And so that's what A is here. So in particular, you see that these C's typically are positive. And so what's happening is that the scalars and the fermions are contributing positively to the beta function for alpha, just like it was for QED. QED would be the special case where that's not zero, but this is the, you know, if we had been doing this for we'd have to figure out what the we can come back and do that. This is some number times Q squared, and the number is probably 4 or something like that. And then there's a similar statement for the scalars, but you would have seen in the homework that the contribution of scalars and fermions have this factor of 2 running around in them and have the same sign when you did the vacuum polarization for scalars in QED and compared it to what the fermions did. But this one being positive is the one that gives you a negative beta function, and that's the famous asymptotic freedom of non-abelian gauge theories. And so as long as you don't have too much matter, then this one wins, then you get asymptotic freedom. And in particular for QCD, this is bigger than those ones are, largely because the 11/3 is so good. Typically for SUN, SUN, C of R would be equal to, I said a 2 here, I think I meant a half. Right? If I take 1/2 a Pauli matrix, 1/2 a Pauli matrix, we're going to get 1/4 the trace of 2 Pauli matrices. But if I take the A equals B, that squares to 1. The trace of 1 in a 2 by 2 trace is 2, so this is a half. So what I said before here was wrong. I think I said 2. That would have been true if the Pauli matrices themselves had been the representation, but it's really a half times Pauli matrices that's the representation. And the general statement is that if you take the defining representation of SUN, so you take an n component vector for which the matrices that represent SUN are n by n unitary matrices, then this is a half in the fundamental, in the defining representation of the fundamental. And so this is the special case of n equals 2. And C of A for SUN is n. What's fun to do is in supersymmetric theories, bosons and fermions come together, and it's fun to assemble them. So if you had supersymmetric theories, so this is just an aside. So for n equals 1 supersymmetry, what happens is that a gauge field, for every gauge field, you've got a spin a half field. So for each spin 1, there's corresponding spin half, and they'll have the same representation. So with R a half equals A, and for each spin 0, each complex spin 0, there'll be a spin a half, and they'll be in the same representation. So let's call it R matter. And so if we take the case where we take 11/3 minus 2/3 for the gauge fermion contribution, that'll be 9/3. So then in that case, we would have had mu, d alpha d mu would have been minus alpha squared over 2 pi. We'd have 3 times the adjuvant representation coming from these guys. And all I've done is I've taken this for the gauge bosons and this for the fermions that are paired off with the gauge bosons. And for the remaining fermions that are paired off with scalars, if they're in the same representation, we're going to get 2/3 minus 2/3 minus 1/3 is minus 1. So we'll get minus C of R matter. And if you have 2 supersymmetries, what happens is that one of these gauge multiplets gets paired off with 3 matter multiplets, and they're all in the same representation. The one gauge multiplet plus 3 matter multiplets fills out a super, that fills out an n equals 2 representation. They all have the same gauge representation because they're all related by supersymmetry. So then this would be the same, you know, we'd have the adjoint here rather than R, but there'd be three of them, and so then this is would vanish. So then mu d alpha d mu equals zero. So there is, if you have a lot of supersymmetry, you get situations where the couplings don't run, because the fermions and the bosons are all conspiring together to give you things that don't change. Yeah, so then you can go past, you can ask if it's true beyond, this is a, so far that's just a one loop calculation I gave you there, and it is more general theory, yeah. Right, so that was a bit of a detour. The thing I should go back to was I said that for Green's functions, we'd have to come back and re-ask the question about let me quickly do it. So if we've been doing this for Green's functions rather than amplitudes, which is another way of avoiding these infrared divergences, right? So here we were thinking we're doing infrared finite some things which are not infrared divergent, like the Bloch-Nortzig thing of summing over soft photons. But alternatively, we just look at correlation functions of operators and not look at S-matrix elements at all. And then the argument changes just a little bit, because we have to follow that if we have a bunch of operators in our matrix element, they all are getting renormalized by some wave function renormalization. And that changes this argument just by, we have to see where the wave function normalization comes in. And it comes in just multiplicatively, because that's what the wave function normalizations do. So we had this before. So for correlation functions, so let's say we call F renormalized as a function of E, or whatever, function of all these variables. Let's say it's some matrix element of, phi renormalized of x, phi renormalized of y. And we might want a Fourier transform it to make it a function of energy, if we like. So we could, then what we know is that these things, because these fields are related to the Baer fields by some renormalization, wave function renormalization, that this is going to be z phi squared, or z phi, depends on how many fields I have here. N times what I would call a Baer correlation function. More generally, if we had a bunch of operators here, we could have had FR could have been a correlation function of, say phi squared normalize of x and some other operator. Maybe it's psi bar gamma mu, or psi bar psi, let's say, of x renormalized. They could each have their own wave function renormalizations. And it's true that wave function renormalizations, phi to the fourth renormalized will be some z1 times phi naught to the fourth. But there might also be a z2 times phi naught box phi. Typically, any operator that has the same dimension, you can get a linear combination of them. You might have to renormalize the linear combination of them to get the matrix elements of any particular operator to be finite. So I guess there's something that needs emphasizing here is that so this wave function normalization of the field itself was something we had to do anyway, right? When we were looking at scattering elements, we had to renormalize all the couplings in the Lagrangian, but we had to also renormalize the fields. And that was corresponded to taking the kinetic terms and making them canonical again. And so that's what we did here. But even if you've done all that, so you have a perfectly finite renormalized system where all scattering matrix elements are finite, if you had calculated correlation functions of operators which are products of fields, they'll diverge. So you have to renormalize composite operators in addition to any renormalizations you had done for the basic fields themselves. And you can kind of see that because if we take an x and y and we made them approach one another, typically a Green's function blows up in that limit. So if we just had two fields, the Green's functions in the small xy limit go like 1 over x minus y squared in four dimensions. And so even if this correlation function had been finite, if we took two of the points in it and made them coincident, we would have gotten a new divergence, which was not renormalized by anything we'd done before. So if you want to look at correlations of phi squared, you have to separately renormalize that operator in addition to anything you've done to make this correlation function finite. So typically, if you have composite operators, they can be renormalized, but they need to be renormalized in addition to any renormalizations we've talked about to date. But it's conceptually very similar that you have it'll be the bare thing times a multiple for low dimension operators. But in general, what happens is that you'll have all the operators, the bare things you could have written down with the same dimension as the operator you're writing down, and they may all renormalize together. And it might not be sufficient to multiplicatively renormalize one of them to get finite matrix elements. So modulo that complication, and I'm going to not worry about mixing. I'm going to imagine you can imagine taking linear combinations of phi to the fourth and phi box phi to get something which does multiplicatively renormalize by diagonalizing this matrix here. So if we do that, and we look at correlations of operators, it's generically, you know, so if f is some correlation function of, you know, operator one, operator two, possibly Fourier transformed, that's going to be some product of, over these operators, of a z for that operator times the bare thing. And the basic generalization of this argument to these guys is that the bare thing is the thing that was independent of scale. So what we relied on here was that if we go over to the, I probably erased it, you know, the thing that was in, this expression was independent of mu, basically. And so when we figured out how g ran, we figured out what mu dg d mu was, we relied on that because we defined this in terms of, we defined a correlation function at energy equal mu was what we meant by g. And on the right-hand side, we had g at some reference point. And it didn't matter what the reference point was, basically, because this expression, physical things don't care about this arbitrary value for mu that you choose to define your couplings. The explicit dependence you have on mu is canceling the implicit dependence you have in the coupling. That same set of words applies to this bare thing, which doesn't depend on the renormalized quantity. So we can do everything we did here, provided that we take the Green's function and divide it by this product of wave function renormalizations that was appearing that renormalizes the operators involved. So if we take, so the argument, we you know, arguments made for gamma above apply also to F renormalized divided by the product of these Zs. Because that's basically, I think, this divided by this, and that's the bare thing, which doesn't really depend on these renormalization points because it's the bare thing. So that means that if I made the analog of this statement for a correlation function, it would be, you know, so the Green's function f var as a function of energy, let's say we Fourier transform it, mass, dimensionless variables, things like g, that would be the product of these z's of z. So I want to make the, let me make the, I don't want to actually do the analog of that, although I could do the analog of that. Let's do the analog of that, actually, that's, since it's written down there. So the analog of that one would be that'll be the product of these z's evaluated at mu divided by the z's I think I did that right. The more useful one is the analog of, you remember at one point, the analog of the statement that, all the words we would say now would be, we're interested in the large E limit, and we choose mu and to be large, mu to be of order E and large compared to the mass, then these expressions are going to be analytic as M over E gets small, and so we can Taylor expand them. Everything's going to go through like before. And the only thing that's going to change is we have to follow this factor here, where if mu is order E, we have these Zs evaluated at an argument of order 1. And the thing is, I guess I want to really write this as Z of E. In the same way that I'm not writing this as a dimensionless scale, in the same way I'm not writing that as a dimensionless scale, if I'm going to be consistent in my notation. Typically, this is a dimensionless function. It's a function that, you know, in our examples, if we solved the renormalization group equation for G here, you know, we would have, what you could do is you could say, well, I could define a lambda to be the place where G goes to infinity. So it's often true that the way you'd solve this would be 1 over G squared. One way of writing the solution is it's equal to B log of mu over lambda, where lambda is just defined to be the point where G naught goes to infinity. So if you use that definition of lambda, you've got a function which is a dimensionless function. If I write mu over E here, that's the same function as long as I write lambda over E everywhere. So it's that's why I'm not really bothering to write it. So the same words go through for the Zs. So that says that in particular. So let's say we take mu to be equal to E and much bigger than M, then we'd have F of R as function of E M X G of E. E would be the product of these things of I'm surprised those guys dropped out. What happened there? Oh, I'm making a stupid argument here. That's sorry. Let me go back here. Where I went wrong was here. Yeah, what I wanted to write here was this is a function of E. I didn't want to do the expansion. I garbled two arguments here, I'm afraid. Yeah, so my first instinct was right. I should have actually gone. Let me make this argument more carefully. The statement was that this thing doesn't depend on the renormalization point because it's the bare thing. So it's this divided by this, which is independent of mu. So let's write that. Let's just choose two values of mu. That's the better statement. Because that's just saying that the bare thing didn't care how you chose your renormalization point. That's the analog of what we did for the scattering amplitudes where it didn't matter whether we used mu on the left-hand side or mu naught on the right-hand side. So it wasn't quite that thing I wrote there. Right. So given that, So the choice I want to make now is it's the one I told you I was going to take. So let's take mu and mu naught to be large. What we'll do is we'll scale mu naught out of this whole thing. I think that's what I want to scale. What I'm going to actually do is I'm going to choose, since mu naught's arbitrary, I'll choose mu naught to be equal to E, and then both be large compared to the mass. Okay, so then we'll have let's pull out the factors. Well, I guess, and I can do two steps here. So if I write this as just E, M, X, G of E and E, that's a statement that mu naught is equal to E. But let's pull a factor of E out. And so that'll be, we'll get E to some dimension. Let's say delta. We'll have M over E, and then we'll have 1 here. But the point is that this is a thing which is smooth, and so we can take it to be 0 plus small. And we have the usual story that the energy dependence of G is appearing here, and so that's going to be something we can determine once and for all from the normalization group, and that's very much like what happened for the gammas. We have this power of E out front, which we can follow. And so this is an expression which tells us what the large E limit of this renormalized quantity was, but it has the additional complication that we have to follow, you know, how Z depends on mu as well. And that's the only change. So because of this, it's useful that we want to know how, in the same way we want to know what G of E was, we want to know what Z of mu is. And so I won't do it, we're out of time here. So you can repeat the same argument I did for the Green's function. Maybe this is the thing to do in the beginning of next class, is that we can, the same way we define the Green's function at a particular value of mu to be what we meant by the normalized couplings, you can define these z's in the same way. You could say that I take the correlation function for two of these operators, and I demand that its Fourier transform at a particular momentum transfer is equal to mu to some power, say. And so rather than using, we were traditionally using Z to make the residue of the propagator 1 at the mass shell, but we're trying not to renormalize in things in a way which involves mass shells, so we can define Z in a different way. We just assign some value for the correlation function for the two operators at some scale to be equal to 1 or some number, and then that'll be another way of determining the Z's, which is not tied to the mass shell. And if we do that, we can use that definition by just essentially differentiating this equation to figure out what the analog is of the renormalization group equation is for Z. And it differs only in the fact that instead of getting an expression for mu, dd mu of the coupling is a function of the coupling, we're going to get that mu dd mu of Z is a function of the coupling times Z. And so the solutions are a little bit different, but and their derivatives have an interpretation as being as an anomalous dimension, which I guess I'll do in the next class. But it's a tweak to what we've done already. All it's doing is saying that for correlation functions, in addition to following the G's, you've got to follow these wave function normalizations. So in addition to following how the couplings run, you want to also follow how these Z's run. And you can define how they run in exactly the same way as we had done before. And then you can ask how they behave in the small coupling limit and all those things like we did before. So I'll do that at the very beginning of next class. That's probably a good place to start.